endless delay or paralysis in Washington in the face of this crisis will only bring deepening disaster. I can tell you that doing nothing is not an option.
Hi, and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. In Washington, D.C., I'm David Kestenbaum.
And in New York, I'm Laura Conaway. This is Monday, February 9th, and boy, is it a big week for economic news. Today, we're going to talk about the $800 billion plus economic stimulus package that's in the Senate right now, and also about the government's new plan for saving banks.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is supposed to unveil that tomorrow on Tuesday. I hope to go to it. For now, I want to do our Planet Money indicator.
Go for it, David.
It is 0.1 to 0.3%. The numbers come from the Congressional Budget Office.
Yeah, the office says that's how much this big economic stimulus package will ultimately shrink the economy.
Yes, shrink the economy. That is for the year 2019. Basically, the idea is that the government is going to be borrowing so much money to pay for the stimulus that it's going to crowd out private investment. So basically, too many people put money into buying treasury bonds, and there's not enough left over for private investment. I should point out that in the short run, it says you do get, you know, you get this bump in GDP, and by the end of 2010, you'd have something like, it says 1.3 million to 3.9 million new jobs. But then when you go way out into the future, there is some drag on the economy.
Yeah, I talked briefly to one economist today, this guy Amir Sufi. I'm hoping to get a little more from him tomorrow. And he was saying that actually, if you just run the strict economic models, the numbers might be worse than what the CBO is saying. A bunch of listeners sent over that blog item, and we'll be following it up on npr.org/money.
As we said a minute ago, the Senate is considering Barack Obama's request for this major stimulus package, and they might vote on ending debate as early as today.
And we're talking about a whole lot of debate.
A whole lot. And not, I mean, not just on Capitol Hill. We got this email from Eric Filcorn. He lives in a small town in Vermont called Richmond. According to the town's website, they have about 4,090 residents. It's tiny. So Eric wrote to us saying that the idea of the stimulus package was causing people up there to behave slightly strangely.
Yeah, Eric serves as a town selectman, which means his phone rings a lot. And he told our colleague Caitlin Kinney that lately he feels like everyone he talks to has been kind of hypnotized by the promise of the check.
I'm involved in the business community and I'm involved in civil government. And on both sides, I keep getting involved in conversations where somewhere, at some point in the conversation, someone will say, ah, but when the stimulus comes, everything will be different. Or, we shouldn't do that yet because it might qualify for the stimulus. We even have a bridge project going on in town. They're about to close our bridge for 6 months. And the state accelerated the process in an amazing, ridiculous way. They're going to be working on it 24/7. But at some point, they had been going forward with the project going, we'll work out where we find the money. We just know this is an important project that needs to get done. And when the stimulus packages started to take shape, suddenly word started coming down, well, we may delay the project just in case we can get stimulus money for it. So I'm seeing things that were locked and loaded suddenly starting to tread water a little bit. As it turns out, we've worked it out so that the project can stay on track and still be eligible. But I'm also hearing from, you know, people in the business community, because I work around renewable energy and stuff, business organizations saying, well, everything will be different in the springtime when the stimulus comes. And I always kind of stop in the meeting and go, you don't know what's coming out of the Senate. You can't count on that. You got to keep working.
So why do you think you're a little bit more skeptical than some of these people who seem so excited about when the stimulus comes?
I probably hang out with too many reporters. You know, I mean, I think because I work in PR, I work with a lot of different kinds of businesses, and also serving in government, I see it from a bunch of different angles in a very small space. You know, the latest round of job losses is about equivalent to the population of Vermont. So you get a real slice of society with a small group of people.
That was Eric Filcorn with Caitlin Kenney. Okay, the other big news this week is the government's latest strategy for rescuing the banks. It seems to keep changing.
Yeah, this one we're going to be hearing more about tomorrow.
Right, but we have there's some inkling of what it is. And basically, it's looking like some sort of public-private partnership. The idea is the government would somehow entice private investors to buy up or help buy up some of the toxic assets.
Yeah, and the question is, if people don't want to buy them already, how do you get them to buy them later? And we're talking about these mortgage-backed securities, these collateralized debt obligations. It's all this general gunk that nobody so far has wanted to buy.
Right. I mean, it's unclear how this thing is going to work at this point. I mean, the general idea seems to be that the government wouldn't have to buy it all. Private investors would go in on it and they'd share some of the losses if things went bad, but also share some of the gains. And I think that, you know, the main question is going to be, how do you divide those things? You don't want the taxpayers holding all the risk and not getting any of the benefit.
Yeah, not especially if I'm one of the taxpayers. I don't think that sounds like a great deal. A few days back, our colleague Adam Davidson saw something about the current situation on Facebook, and it was the status update from an economist named Adam Posen, who works with the Peterson Institute, and said, Adam, meaning Posen, is very happy the Obama team and Democratic leadership are moving on big public stimulus, a little less happy about the too wimpy financial reforms.
You don't see that kind of status update very often on
no,
Facebook.
No, you don't. Yeah. And we just couldn't resist. Adam Davidson and I called Adam Posen to ask him what he meant by that too wimpy financial reforms bit.
Well, it's good you didn't read the previous status, Adam, which was about my visit to Burns Steakhouse in Tampa. the two wimpy financial reforms are, we're in a very dangerous place right now. The banks are in a halfway house between being private and public, at least the big money center banks.
Wait. We're anti-jargon here on Planet Money.
Sorry.
Money center bank, I was like, what does that mean? What does that mean? It's just a big bank that you've heard of, Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase.
It's a big bank you've heard of that has lots of people you're doing transactions with. That's why it's the center. It's at the, talk about social networking. It's at the center of a cluster of transactions. That's what makes it a money center bank.
Right. And generally in New York or London.
Yeah, although nowadays there were ones headquartered in Charlotte in the U.S. and there are ones on the West Coast. But generally it's New York, London, Tokyo, Singapore, Frankfurt.
Yeah. Okay. So big banks.
The big banks are all in this funny halfway house where they're guaranteed a lot of stuff by the U.S. government or the Federal Reserve. They have got U.S. government stakes in them, which may or may not strictly translate into ownership stakes. But at the same time, they've got private shareholders. They've got private managers who are very eager to hold on to their jobs and their budgets for spending on carpets in their offices.
And bonuses.
And bonuses and all the rest of it. And you've got them trying to make a profit. And this kind of financial hybrid situation doesn't work. I mean, we saw this with Fannie and Freddie, which were the most egregious examples. They were busy trying to supposedly serve a public interest while also make profits for their shareholders. And, you know, you should define which it's going to be. Some cases, making profits for your shareholders is the public interest, in which case the government shouldn't be there. And in some cases, the government interest has to trump, in which case the profit motive shouldn't be there. But this mixed stuff tends to be very dangerous, and that's where we are with a large part of the U.S. banking system right now.
So what would the government getting tough on the banks look like?
The government getting tough on the banks would look like things we saw the U.S. government do in the mid-80s with the savings and loan crisis. We saw the Swedish government do with their banks they had a terrible crisis in the early 90s. And the Japanese finally got around to doing with their banks in around 2001. Tough means you send in government officials, and there's plenty of unemployed bank examiners we can make into government officials right now. You go through the books and you say 90% of this is worth nothing. We're going to pay you.
These are all the toxic assets.
Toxic assets, loans that are impaired, meaning people are behind on paying them, stuff that is illiquid, meaning people don't know how to value it, mortgages that are in foreclosure, all of which probably has some worth, but they don't have any worth right now. And so you say to the banks, well, this is really all you have left when we pay you what they're worth right now. And the bank says, then I don't have anything left. And you say, too bad, and then all the managers are shown the door and all the shareholders are shown the door and it's bankrupt. And we have a very special procedure for how to handle a bankrupt bank. And then you take all these toxic assets and the U.S. government basically pays what's left of the bank a discounted value of those assets and then tries to sell them.
I thought everything that the Treasury Department and the Fed are doing is trying to keep these banks alive, and you're saying what they should do is kill them.
I'm saying that you should kill their ownership and their management. Kill in the – not I don't mean personally, but –
although some of them make you want to actually kill
them. Yeah, but
them,
I want to be clear. Yeah. I'm not threatening any violence here, just financial move. You want at the end of the day to have a banking system that does do what it traditionally does, which is make loans on good candidates and speculate and moderates way and pursues profit in a constructive way. And you can't get from the first to the second without, like, shutting them down in Las Vegas. You have to get them out of the casino, sober them up a bit, retrain them, and put them back out into their job. And the way you do that is you have to shut the banks, you have to consolidate some banks, you have to force them to take their losses. The sad news is if you do that, that's usually bad for the economy while it's happening. And this is the trade-off that I think the Obama team and the Congress have not yet really faced up to.
Because it's – I mean, it sounds like a nuclear option. I hate that phrase, but I don't know what else to say. It sounds like – I mean, in the U.S., it's nationalization. It's right. The government coming in and destroying
– They're not destroying anything. They are – this is the government coming in and declaring a federal disaster area at a toxic waste site instead of not marking it and letting kids continue to drink from the groundwater.
So you're saying whatever bank, and I sort of want to mention some banks, but maybe it's best not to.
Better not to.
But that there are banks today that are technically open for business. They technically have, you know,
right,
value on their stock, in their stocks. They have chief management. But those banks are really dead.
They're really dead because, A, their behavior is as though they're dead once their capital gets low, even if it is a little bit above zero. And, B, in practice, if you really evaluate what they got, their capital probably is negative. Paul Krugman had a nice column in the New York Times talking about this. He made up a bank called Gotham. And Gotham Bank.
Gotham being a city.
Yes. But
so Gotham Bank.
A New York-based city. Gotham Bank, you know, that on paper has $200 billion left in capital, but that's in part because they got $400 billion of these assets that they're valuing at someday worth $400 billion when they're really worth $25 billion. So that if you really do a fair accounting, these banks don't have anything. And that was what we saw in Japan. That was what we saw in the U.S. in the 80s. You have zombie banks that have no real money left. They make bad decisions. They just accumulate more bad debt, which then we have to clean up later. So like I said about the toxic waste site, you know, it's not a question of the government going in and destroying it. It's a question of government going in and stopping it before it continues to seep out and poison other people.
So why don't they do it?
They don't want to do it for several reasons. First is once they cross that barrier, there's a huge burden on the government's balance sheet, on your and my federal government budget, that until they sell off all these assets, which we don't know how much they'll get back for, looks like a lot more debt. They don't want to do it because the U.S. in general doesn't like to admit they're nationalizing anything. That's why we have all these strange hybrids like we used to have with Fannie and Freddie and these quasi-public entities. In economic terms, it's better to either nationalize or be private than the quasi, but that's how the U.S. does it. But thirdly, and I think the biggest motivation is there's a huge amount of popular resentment and fear that we're giving all this money to the banks. It's not doing us any good, right? They're not lending. The economy's not growing as a result of the money we're giving the banks. And nobody wants to say, well, actually, that's how it works. We're going to have to put more money into the banks, and they're basically going to have to stop lending for a little while to clean this up.
So is basically the president and the Congress are in denial? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they're in wishful thinking. And they're understandably in denial. But this is why government is tough, right? Because you're always trying to do multiple things with one policy. You're trying to make a green economy, and you're trying to structure for future generations, and you're trying to be bipartisan, and you're trying to loosen people's tax load, and you're trying to float the economy, and you're trying to fix the banking system. You can't quite do all that at once.
David, I checked in with Adam Posen again today because I wanted to hear what he thinks about Geithner's sort of emerging plan for the banks. And the short answer is it's still not tough enough. He says he does have some sympathy for the government's position, for people like Geithner and Larry Summers, who's advising President Obama, but not too much sympathy.
If I put myself in their shoes, I mean, they're worried, I think excessively worried, that during this transitional period, if you shut down the banks, the government will be making lending decisions. Well, for the time being, all they would do is roll over current lending decisions, so I'm not sure it's that bad. But they're worried about that. They're also worried, both economically and politically, that if they really shut down all the banks that need shutting down and reorganization, they're going to be shutting down an enormous amount of assets. In other words, the federal government, at least temporarily, will have to put on its books a whole bunch of money invested in these banks and hundreds of billions of dollars. And both economically and politically, they're scared about that. They think that'll tip things in terms of
kind of debate we're seeing over the stimulus now in terms of interest rates.
Is this
my
sort of...
problem is that the money's gone. So pretending that we don't want to do that doesn't do anything.
When you say the money's gone, you mean the banks have already, they're holding things that aren't worth anything, the value already drained out.
Exactly. I mean, so there's all this talk about what's called mark-to-market, which is you price things at the price they're currently at. And right now it's very difficult to do because a lot of these assets, particularly involving mortgages or fancy kinds of securities of insurance, are called toxic. Nobody wants to buy them because nobody's sure what they're really worth. And so if you were marking the market, you'd mark them at zero or play close to that. And the banks will whine and say, oh, well, but, you know, if you just give us time, it'll come back someday, and then it'll be worth something. You won't have to bail us out. But the question is, what do they do while they have that time? And the answer is usually they get more into debt and cause more problems.
I'm hearing quit your whining. That's what I'm hearing, Adam.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a little unhappy that this administration doesn't want to force them. I mean, they Summers, Geithner, many of the leaders on the economic side of this administration during the 90s, you know, walked around Asia when there was a financial crisis there and basically told their governments to say, quit your whining, shut them down, do the right thing. They were right then. It's just now they got to apply the same tough love at home.
A little less fun there.
Exactly. It's always harder when it's your politicians who are screaming at you.
Laura, thanks for following up on that. Folks, we'll be back podcasting on Wednesday.
But you can keep in touch with us and the news and each other all week on the blog, npr.org/money. I'm Laura Conaway. Send pictures of the economy. We need them.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thanks for listening.
It's the trees of this day.